Welcome to Film Forum's podcast. The following event was recorded on October 12th, live at our theaters located at 209 West Houston Street in Manhattan.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I am really pleased to be here. I'm Richard Lorber. We're Kino Lorber, the company that's distributing the film tonight that you're going to see. And I first of all want to ask all of you to make sure to, even though you haven't seen the film yet, please tell all your friends how much you like it. I don't think you'll be disappointed. It was a great surprise and astonishment for me to first see this film at South by Southwest last year, where it won the top prize for documentary, and it's gone on to get great acclaim and will get more acclaim and more attention. And we're in a tight race for the Oscars, too, but that's another story. More importantly, it's a film that deals with issues that are very powerful and very disturbing, and the film addresses those issues in a way with a creative strategy that a quite brilliant director, Keith Maitland, pursued to create an intimacy with the subject that allows you to feel the experience in a way that more pure documentary approach might not. I don't want to say anything more to, you know, prejudice you about the film one way or another, but the most important thing right now for me to do is to introduce you to Keith Maitland, based filmmaker, hence the origin of the film from the events in Austin, who is, here with us tonight. And Keith will be attending the Q&A after the screening, along with his producer, Megan Kilbrand, and producer Meredith Vieira. So I encourage all of you to stick around after the screening and have a chance to kind of chat up Keith and Meredith and Megan. But right now, I'm really delighted to introduce you to a quite brilliant and resourceful filmmaker, Keith Maitland.
Thanks, Richard.
Thank you. It's so exciting to premiere a film. It's that much more exciting to premiere a film in your favorite movie theater in the world. This is the Film Forum, and I love the Film Forum, not because of these incredibly comfortable seats or the spacious eye lines, but because of what the Film Forum represents and what it's meant for filmmakers from New York City for 50 years or more. It meant that for me when I was a young filmmaker living here, a mile away from here. It's the only movie theater that I've ever woke up on a Saturday and said, I wanted to go see a movie, and I didn't check to see what was playing. I just went to the theater. So this really means a lot. It means that much more because so many of my favorite people in the world are here in the room tonight. Those include my family, my wife, my crew, and the loved ones of our cast. Unfortunately, our cast members aren't here tonight, but you're going to see them up on the screen, and I hope that they inspire in you a conversation that we're all eager to have. And so to that end, we will stick around afterwards and have that conversation. I hope you'll stick around with us, or else we'll be talking to these comfy seats by ourselves. But it's going to be myself, my producer, Megan Gilbride, and incredible Meredith Vieira, executive producer on the film, who'll be joining us. So I've said more than I need to. All I really need to say is thank you for being here. So thank you for being here, and I hope you enjoy the show.
Please help me welcome Keith Maitland, Megan Gilbride, and Meredith Vieira. As they get settled. I'm Adam Walker. I'm the director of publicity here at Film Forum. I just want to say thank you all so much for this incredible and vital piece of work.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you all for sticking around.
Indeed.
So we're going to take some audience questions. I'll ask a couple to get the ball rolling, and then we'll throw it out to you guys. If you'll just wait for the microphone to ask your question, we do podcast our Q&As, so we want to be sure and get your question. So you went to UT, right? So just want to talk a little bit about maybe when this story kind of first came into your consciousness in your life, and kind of what about it, you know, made you as a filmmaker want to represent it. And then Meredith and Megan, if you want to talk about sort of how it came to you and your sort of own personal journey with that.
Sure. Before I do that, though, I would like to just take a moment to recognize the cast and crew, many of whom names have been scrolling by. But we have a really incredible, you see how many people it takes to make an independent film. And more often than not, the incredible amounts of publicity and information that we are trying to get out there to get people's attention in a crowded film landscape, a lot of times it comes back on me. And I just want to take this opportunity to share what is often given to me, because I can't do it alone, and I don't do it alone. And Megan and Meredith are here with me up on the stage, and I'm excited to hear what they have to say tonight. But we also have great crew members out there in the audience. Some of them are in the back. I would just ask, if you're a crew member or a cast member and you're here, would you just raise your hand, just so we have a round of applause? I'd like to. So we've got our music composer, Osei Ased, who's here, and our coordinating producer, Hillary Pierce, and executive producer, Amy Rapp, and my wife, executive producer and cinematographer, Sarah Wilson. And we've got a associate producer named Mary Beth Minnis, who's here. Coordinator Scott Maitland, who's here. And we even have an intern from the film here, Jesus, who's in the audience.
Yeah.
Somewhere there he is. We have our brilliant actress, Violet Bean, who played Claire, is here. And so while the three of us are thrilled to answer any questions, we didn't do it alone, and we can't. And those guys, as long with our families and an incredible network of support, both in Austin and New York, we all did it together. So...
You went to UT, and how did the...
Yeah, so...
Go back to Adam's original...
So we made a movie.
Let's be on topic. We can be on topic.
You. This is why she's a producer. I learned about the Tower shooting in seventh grade in my Texas history class. I didn't learn about it because it was on the statewide curriculum in Texas. First of all, every seventh grader in Texas takes Texas history for an entire year. And in that Texas history, they teach you about the Alamo. They teach you about cowboys and Indians. There's lots of things they leave out, and one of the things they leave out is the Tower shooting. But I learned about it because my teacher was there that day. So the first person who ever told me about the Tower shooting was a witness who described a scene very similar to what you guys... I was always curious about it. Years later, I went to the University of Texas, and I assumed I would learn about it, but the university didn't have much of a relationship with that history, so I didn't learn almost anything about the shooting. It wasn't until I read an incredible article in Texas Monthly by an incredible writer named Pamela Koloff, New York City's own Pamela Koloff, yeah. And Pam interviewed people who were on the ground that day, like Claire, like Neil Speltz, the radio reporter, and Ramiro Martinez, one of the police officers. And it was through their words that I was inspired to make this film. And it was while I was reading the article that I said, I need to make a movie of this. This is a story that needs to be told. And the magazine did an incredible job, but I'm a filmmaker and I wanted to see it on the screen. And so the process began there. That was 10 years ago. And here we are. Megan, how did you get involved?
Keith and I worked on a job for money once together.
Money, what's that?
What's that? And then three years ago, Keith came to me and I heard you retell the story recently. He was like, oh, I was going to sit Megan down and say, I'm looking for a party. Like, can you recommend anyone to me? And that happens to me a lot, actually. And usually I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm busy. But Keith pitched the story, and I was like, I'm going to do this. And then, and Susan Thompson, my fellow producer, was already attached, and we had to do like a dating thing. Like, Keith had worked with me before. We had to, like, I talked to them about my ideas and what was I going to bring to the table, what we were all going to do together. But you pitched it to me, and I was like, I see it, I get it, I want to do it, let's do it. And that was it. And that was 3 years ago.
And then a year, friend Amy Rapp here in the audience, who works with Meredith Vieira for Meredith Vieira Productions, and I had a great meeting during Independent Film Week. And what did Amy Rapp say to you, Meredith?
She came to me and she said, I have this amazing film by this amazing director that I think we should get involved with. And I saw a little bit of it, and I saw the animation, and being the visionary that I am, I said, this is stupid. This is never going to work. You're taking such a serious topic. And I had covered Virginia Tech. So, I mean, the topic, the overall topic, obviously resonated with me. And I thought, you cannot possibly use animation to tell this kind of story. Amy, being the far smarter person and younger, said, you're wrong. It is great storytelling. It's innovative and it's different. And it's probably the only way that we can take an audience back to that time, because there's very little archival footage. And I said, okay, and so glad that I did, because I'm incredibly proud to be associated with this and to be associated with both of you. I think this film is so powerful and right now resonates. Keith said to me that when he first started working on the film, several people said to him, why would anybody care about a shooting that occurred 50 years at the University of Texas? And it was only a few months later that we had Sandy Hook. And it was a reminder why we should care. And I think that given the fact that we live now in a society, in a world where we're no longer shocked by school shootings, we should be. They were then, because you'd never seen anything like that. In fact, they thought it was firecrackers, as you know, not gunshots. What's happened to us that we now no longer are shocked? We're sad, but we're not shocked. So I thought the relevance of this film was so important, and I wanted to be part of it, even a little small part.
Well, you've been a big part of it this week. Meredith has taken the work that we all worked on together and is helping broadcast it to the world, and making people aware that this small independent film from Austin, Texas exists. And here we are on night one of our theatrical run.
So Meredith touched on the animation, and I was just curious, at what point in the process did that become sort of evident that that was going to be something that you were going to either need to employ because of a dearth of archival footage, or use as a sort of storytelling tool, which I think is an incredibly effective one?
Thank you. I'll be honest, the idea for the animation came, it was while reading the article. And the reason is because, as you see in the film, most of the people, as they tell their story, they say, I started in the student union, and then I ran across the mall, and I ended up in the English building, and then I ran over to the Jefferson Davis statue. Well, I went to the University of Texas, and I know where all of those places are, and I immediately was placed there while reading the article, and I wanted the film to do that same thing for audiences, whether you know the campus of the University of Texas or not. And so the animation was a way to be able to place an audience right into the story and not just rely on talking head interviews to say these things, but to show them and to give us an opportunity to feel them. And then as we developed it further, we realized if we want to appeal to young audiences, which is what I want to do, we need to find a way to take the story of Claire, who's an incredible person, but she's a 68-year-old woman. And I know when I was an 18-year-old young man, I didn't relate that well to 68-year-old women. But I was trying very hard to relate to 18-year-old women. And so if we could show 18-year-old Claire, then maybe these kids that I want to talk to would see themselves up there. And the reason I want to talk to them is because it's these kids that live under the threat of this violence every day. And so I can see from looking out in the crowd, some of you probably remember 1966. Some of us came along just a few years after 1966. But for teenagers, for 18-year-olds, 16-year-olds, 20-year-olds, that's a long time ago. And I just wanted to transcend that distance. And I thought, well, if we can find somebody who can embody Claire's story, then maybe a young person could do that. And that's why, you know, Violet Bean was exactly the right person to do that for me. And the animation was exactly the right way to kind of connect the dots between her performance and Claire's memories. And so that's where the animation came from.
It was very successful. And you did a beautiful job, Violet.
Yay! Woo!
Any questions from the audience?
Oh, right there. Hi, good evening. The actual interviews, now, did you tailor those for the animation? Or in certain cases, you can tell that it was footage that from interviews that had been taken previously to your production. But for the ones that you could get that were still alive, did you tailor them for the storytelling that you wanted?
Well, kind of. You know, so the process for this film was basically interview people who lived through this experience and survived. You know, we settled on 8 characters, but we spoke to and interviewed both in person and on the telephone dozens and dozens of people. Actually, over 100 people have shared their story with us. But for the purpose of the film, we narrowed it down to those 8 stories. And of those 8 stories, 6 of those folks are still with us, and they told their story directly to me. Some of them had told their story to Pam, and that was how we met them. But then I asked them to tell their story to me. And so we did these long-form interviews. Some of them got pretty deep, and they lasted a while. And there was a part of it that was catered to the animation because I knew that we wanted to take this approach. And so beyond just saying, tell me what you remember, we also then pushed past that and said, you know, what were you wearing that day? What color was your dress? You know, what do you remember seeing around you? What do you remember hearing? When you looked to the left, what did you see? When you looked to the right, what did you see? And it was amazing. I was just trying to gather information to tell a full story in the animation. But through the process of doing that, I watched Claire and Artley and Martinez and Alec Hernandez, the boy who was shot off his bicycle. I watched them access parts of their memory that they hadn't thought of, that didn't make it into the kind of the thumbnail sketch of the story. You know, we all live through something and then we remember it, and then we share it in some way or another. But to say, when you look to the left, what did you see? Was enlightening because I watched them access these new, old, and that led to a deeper understanding of the entire thing. And it also gave me the tools I needed to fill in the three-dimensional world. The main part of interviewing them was to get their stories and to get the emotional connection to this history, and then to take that, carve it down into a shooting script that resembled what you saw, and then cast actors to portray those memories.
And I would say too, you know, like in a kind of traditional, like, you know, documentary interview or verite situation, you have transcripts and you have all the footage, you have the footage transcript, and you literally go in and you say, I'm going to highlight this. I want to use this clip. I'm going to let this go. I'm not going to use this clip. And we did that traditional process. We're looking for, this is a scene that should be animated, or this is a scene that we need more detail about, or this is a scene that's going to end up in, you know, like a part of the interview is going to end up later in the film. And that's just a traditional kind of documentary process. But that's sort of how we talked about kind of how to tell the narrative of that day, which is just, you know, it's just a different way of envisioning it once you actually kind of call that stuff down.
This is more of a comment than a question, but I thought when the movie goes to color, when Claire is describing her love for Tom, I thought that was incredibly moving, and also I think it gives the audience some relief because it's such an emotional film to watch. Difficult, really, and it was just at a point in the film when you thought, how much more can I watch, you know? Could you talk?
Yeah, I think we were feeling the same way you are.
Yeah.
And we knew that audiences would feel that way because it is. It's such a heart-wrenching scenario. But what was amazing about Claire is that every time Tom's name came up in our interview process, Claire would get a little glint in her eye. And she just loves talking about Tom. And so every word that she said in that scene was something that she said about Tom when I asked her, well, tell me about Tom. And I just loved the way she lit up in the interviews. And then she went back to kind of talking about the rest of that day. And we would all feel the weight of that day. And we'd almost kind of go, well, let's talk about Tom again, because we need that in this interview process. And so so that's kind of where that was born out of. As far as the use of color, we, you know, as filmmakers, like, you kind of come up with a grammar that makes sense for that film. And it's something that I had some ideas about, and I pitched them to Megan and to Susan and to the rest of our team and our editor, Austin Reedy. And we kind of made a decision. We would use color to signify the time in these characters' lives before realization of what was happening. So in the beginning of the film, each character is introduced in color, and each character has their moment of kind of the color fading away or sliding away into the black and white palette. But for that scene with Claire, because she was describing a flashback to that great romance that she and Tom shared, it only made sense to go back to color and honestly to play with the visuals of the 60s, which, you know, are so great.
I also think, too, like, I don't know about your lives, but I have so many moments in my life where something, you know, genuinely horrible. Like, of course, never lived through something as you know, intense as this. But you have something genuinely horrible happen to you, and you have these moments of absurdity, and they might make you laugh, and that laugh is your own personal, like, relief valve, like, going off, even if a really, really horrible thing is happening. And we were kind of a little bit looking for those moments in the histories and the interviews because we knew it was going to be so intense for the audience, and we would all need that relief. I like to tell the anecdote where Ray Martinez got nearly to the top of the tower, and he wasn't where the shooter was, and he was actually banging down doors of where the shooter was, and he banged down a door, and six nuns in full habit, and I said, Keith, where is the nuns in the movie? When are we going to get to the nuns? I love the nuns. That's that relief moment. That's that laugh that we need in this, you know, horrible thing that's going to happen on either side of it for a long time. And the nuns never got animated, which I was really disappointed about. It's made a nice anecdote when I tell these stories. But, you know, we were looking for those because those moments of the absurd happen. You know, it's like when something horrible in your life is happening, it doesn't mean that it's all that thing. Like, there's going to be a moment where you laugh or a moment where you're devastated. And I think, you know, we wanted to kind of honor the truth of the experience thing might happen, where even he could get to the top and he's got his gun leveled and the elevator opens and the other cops have their gun leveled. And he, you know, I love it when he says, Jesus, I don't know. You know, like, it's like they don't know what's going on. And I think you have to, drama doesn't have to just be unrelenting. It can also be those moments that we all have where something absurd is happening and it makes us laugh even amongst the most horrible thing.
I think that makes it more relatable too. I mean, the fact that you have the couple arguing about whether she's eating properly, you know, and they're clearly in love, and you have the two guys on the bed playing a game and thinking, oh, this is just, let's go check this out, this is fun, or Crumb giving the finger, which I love, personally. There are so many elements to it, and that's what makes it such a human film. I think that's what makes you connect to it. If it were just the horror alone, that's more comic book to me. We're far more complex as people and as a society, and you see that many things happened on that day, and some of them were really beautiful, and some of them were very horrible, and there were heroics, and there was the woman who said, I'm a coward. So you saw the whole range of what it means to be human. And that's what made, for me, such a relatable film and such a beautiful film.
All right. Thanks. I'm curious about the decision to not focus on the killer, which I thought was totally brilliant, but not a conventional decision. How'd that come about?
You know, that's a decision that wasn't, you know, an instantaneous decision. That's a decision that we actually weighed pretty heavily. We went back and forth on it. I think it was born out of the fact that some of the people we interviewed made it a real point to never say his name. They said, I don't want to engage with him. I don't even want to give him the credit of having existed as a person. So they always call him the sniper or the shooter. And for the most part, we kind of adopted that idea in our process to be sensitive to those people. But something kind of happened fairly early in the process. And I really have to credit our producer, Susan, who can't be here today, because once we made the decision, she kind of became the person who kept us honest to that. You know, as a documentary filmmaker, my favorite aspect of the film is actually the research phase. It's I get to read everything that I can get my hands on. And so I can tell you anything you could ever want to know about that sniper and his life. But what I couldn't ever answer is the question of why did he do it? I could tell you the details of what it was like and what his habits were and things he had expressed to people. But none of those things add up to why did he do this? And so I always kept saying to my team, I think this is an unanswerable question. And once we kind of all looked at each other and said, well, then let's not ask it. Because there are answerable questions. What did Claire feel? What did Martinez feel? What did the community of Austin, how did they respond? Those are all answerable. And so once we had a very clear boundary and a guide to what the film could be. None of us, I appreciate that you use the word brilliant. That's a great word to describe our work. None of us thought that it was a brilliant idea. If anything, we thought maybe we were shooting ourselves in the foot.
Yeah, right.
But something brilliant has emerged since we finished the film. And it's about the way that audiences have responded. And I don't mean audiences here in New York or audiences in Austin where we're from, but I mean audiences around the world. I just got back from London 3 days ago. We've shown the film to audiences all over. And somebody said something to me which really blew me away. They said, you think this story happened in Austin in 1966, but I'm here to tell you this story happened in Tel Aviv at a bus station when that bus exploded. And just this summer in Nice, when a man drove a truck through a promenade full of people on Bastille Day, this story happened again. And it's because it's a human story, and it's because there will always be a Claire, and there will always be a Rita, and there will always be a Martinez and a McCoy. If you keep it focused on the survival techniques of humans, but if you focus on the ideology of one person and the specific minutiae of details of that person in those unanswerable questions, I don't know whether people around the world would relate to it as they have. And we'll never know, because that's an unanswerable question, too.
Yeah. And also, too, you know, there's a point when you're like making a film that's animated where you can't really change the decisions you've made from a storytelling perspective. You just got to have to like shoot it and animate it and do it and get it out. There's realities like that. But unfortunately, a number of shootings happened when we were making this film. And there's a sort of media arc. There's a sort of a narrative. I feel like right now we're in a cycle where people want to give more credence to the amazing humanity that's on display when these things happen. Like in Nice, you know, the look for the helpers, if you see that on Facebook when something happens. And so it was, I think, not that it became easier, but like you said, a guiding principle. Like because there were media narratives about things like this that were coming up while we were making the film, it's like a little bit of a response to what was happening, was to just to stay with Claire and to stay with Artley and to stay with James Love and Rita and Ray and McCoy. And I think we feel really lucky to be able to do that. And you guys.
I think we have time for just one more question.
Film, like everybody says. One of the things that was equally surprising to me when I think about universities
and where this took place, is it seemed to me that nobody talked about this, that there was this huge community silence. And I wondered if that surprised you and whether I'm reading into it too much, whether this had value to the participants, and was that your experience?
I would say it was our experience that there was a catharsis through the people that we dealt with and the community that was focused on and born out of this process. You know, the microphone's over here, right? I'm going to ask John. Do you mind talking? There's someone in our audience I want to introduce. Is John Wilson? He's the brother of Claire Wilson. John has seen the film before. And I was so excited that he wanted to see it again. John, could you answer that question?
I can. As has been said, there was no talk about this at the University of Texas for 40 years, and Claire really didn't have, other than family, anybody to talk to. She didn't meet any of these people other than, I guess, Rita at the hospital. And this has been enormously therapeutic for her. She's, and of course, the last few years, the Texas Monthly article, and then this, working with you, meeting all these people, it's been very good for her. I'm getting pretty emotional about it, just to see how she's sort of come alive and talking about this in the last few years, but it's also personally important. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you all so much for being here and for this really important film. Thank you. Thank you. Have a good night, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Film Forum's podcast. Visit us online at filmforum.org, where you can learn more about our films, memberships, subscribe to our free weekly e-newsletter, and to find out the ways you can support our nonprofit cinema. And if you have the time, please visit our iTunes page and leave a rating and review of our podcasts. Copyright to this program belongs to The Moving Image Incorporated.